1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Welcome to Feldis and Kale. Great to have you with us. We're presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Dan, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, Ken?
I'm just full of energy. I'll put it that way. I was going to say something else, but full of energy.
There you go. Yep.
And I think our guest is too. Our guest today is one who was brave enough to return to Feldis and Kale. It's state representative from Ward 5 in Concord and in Hopkinton, Dave Luno. And Dave, welcome back to the program. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be with you this morning.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, for joining. Thank you for your service to the state and for all the stuff that you've done in the past, Hopkinton School Board, all of your service, all of your help and support for the community. So obviously, your big expertise, one of your big expertises is in education funding. You chaired the Education Funding Commission, bipartisan effort. And before we get to the results of that commission and the work that you led so ably, talk a little bit about what happened with respect to education funding and education policy in this very right-wing radical state budget.
Well, thanks, Dan, and thanks for the introduction there. And I mean, this budget is really, you know, devastating in a lot of different ways. And you know, I'd sort of characterize it as clearly the most corrupt budget we've ever seen in state history. And you know, where we've got all sorts of shenanigans going on, like, you know, $100 million in sweetheart tax deals that are going to companies like Apple, Amazon, and Walmart, where it's billed out as a tax break for small businesses. But it's just not. I mean, the fact is that 76 companies, big companies, pay half of all the business taxes in New Hampshire, and nearly 60,000 small companies don't pay any business profits tax at all. I mean, this is not about mom and pop businesses. And then we've got all these other giveaways too. You know, $15 million in grants to wealthy communities, and $10 million and a $10 million gift to cover investment losses by wealthy investors, one of whom actually serves on the House Finance Committee, and a school voucher program, most expansive in the country, which could cost up to $70 million a year just to pay tuition for kids who already go to private school. I mean, this is just insane. And it's probably also worth mentioning that current and former state reps serve on the board of the independent contractor that that administers this program and gets a 10% cut off the top. So what's this all mean? Well, it means reducing grants to schools by nearly $100 million over the next 2 years. And, I mean, New Hampshire already is at in the basement of nationally in terms of you know, the state that provides the least amount of in state share for supporting public education, and school districts like Manchester, Derry, and Rochester are looking to lose more than $5 million each. And you know, I guess the bottom line is, who's going to pay for all of this? And at the end of the day, it's going to be you know, people like you and me who are going to have to make up for the difference on local property taxes, or see our student outcomes and quality of education suffer.
Well, this really stands in stark contrast to the last budget, and you know, I've called it a tale of two state budgets. If you look at the last budget that Dave and I and Mary Jane Wallner and others worked on, it was historic education funding from the state to our local communities to help with education, help our kids, help our property taxpayers, including finally fully supporting full-day kindergarten like any other grade, without tying kindergartners to Keno, which was absurd to begin with, notwithstanding the enjoyment of playing Keno, Ken.
That's right, and I get a lot out of it, a lot of enjoyment out of playing Keno, because I don't mind losing that money if it goes to the kids.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, if you look at that budget compared to this budget, I don't know how anyone out there could conclude that this budget made much sense at all.
Right, right. First, I should clarify, Ken, you keep losing that Keno money because those dollars still go to support public education.
Right.
So there you go. As all of the lottery revenues do. So
I think it's over $2 billion now since 1964.
Over $2 billion since 1964, but I think you got to put that in context, too. All in statewide, we spend a little over $3 billion every year public education.
Yep.
And we get good outcomes from that. State average outcome is among the best in the country. I mean, we might be a scotch behind Massachusetts, but we're right up there in the top nationally top five, I think, is where New Hampshire generally lands. I mean, we've got a lot to be proud of when it comes to, student performance, student outcomes across in the state. But unfortunately, what we learned in the School Funding Commission is we're just not seeing that everywhere. And while we get good outcomes in the town where I'm sitting right now here in Hopkinton, student outcomes are really solid. Something like 80, the average kid in Hopkinton is something like the 80th percentile or 85th percentile. The average kid in Manchester is at the 5th percentile. Our largest school district, 13,000 kids, the average, 5th percentile. I mean, who's proud of that? And that's a function, actually, of our inequitable school funding system. And that's really the eye-popping, conclusion, finding that the School Funding Commission uncovered.
Dave, I think a lot of people, and myself included, I'll be among that number, really don't know exactly how education is funded, and in terms of how much comes from the state and how much comes from the local municipality.
Right, right. No, it's that's a good question, and the answer is that about 32% of that $3.2 billion comes from the state of New Hampshire, and it comes in the form of what's called an adequacy grant from the state, and about 10% of that is actually from the statewide education property tax. So honestly, only about 21-22% of that is from state dollars that are not raised through local property taxes. And when you look at either one of those numbers, New Hampshire's dead last in the country in terms of state funding or the state funding share for public schools. The rest of that comes from a tiny little bit from the federal government, and the rest is on local property taxpayers, and you see it across the state. I mean, you see some places that have incredible property wealth. So think towns that are fortunate to have either an ocean or a big lake or ski resorts in their area. They have fairly a lot of property wealth and fairly low property taxes, and then you get every place else in the state, or just about every place else in the state, that doesn't have that property tax base. Certainly here in Hopkinton, but other places too. I mean, names like places like Claremont, Berlin, Pittsfield, Newport. I mean, and they have property tax rates that are 10 times higher than close to 10 times higher than what you see in some of the more property wealthy communities. So what does that mean? It means for a homeowner that's living in a $350,000 home, which actually I think what I just saw is below state average now, is in those communities, is paying about the same in property taxes as somebody living on the seacoast living in a $3.5 billion home.
Our guest is State Representative Dave Luneau, and Dave represents Ward 5 in Concord and Hopkinton. as well. And Dave, hang with us. We are going to take a quick break here. It's Feldis and Kale at 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back, 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. State Representative Dave Luno is with us, and we're talking about the ramifications of the recently passed state budget. And I know both you and Dan have strong feelings about what was passed. And and Dave, you called it, I think I'm using the term you used, a corrupt budget.
Yeah. Yeah, it's most definitely a corrupt budget, and you know, and it's corrupt in a lot of different ways. I mean, it's corrupt from honestly a real corruption standpoint. When you take a look at some of the, you know, a lot of times budgets are summed up by winners and losers, but when you take a look at who some of the winners are and where some of the winners live, that's where the money's going. You know, sweetheart tax breaks to big corporations, grants to property wealthy towns, the ones that are already paying some of the lowest property tax rates in the state, and you know, millions of dollars to cover investment losses by wealthy investors who got caught up in a scam trying to skirt around the law. So it's corrupt in those ways. It's corrupt on the way where you take a look at who's benefiting from voucher programs, and right out of the gate, it's you know, families who are already sending their kids to private schools qualify, and a independent contractor that administers the program that just happens to have current and former state reps serving on their board, and it's also corrupt from the standpoint of what it takes away from funding our local schools and widening the opportunity gap that we see across the state. So this budget does not do better for the students in Manchester. It doesn't do better for the students in Newport or Claremont or Pittsfield or Berlin. There are so many places across the state where we need to close that opportunity gap. We need to make sure that that students, no matter what district they go to, receive a strong education and right out of the, you know, right on graduation and while they're in school, can be contributing members to our workforce and our economy.
Let's talk about that opportunity gap. I think that's a key phrase. It comes in part from Robert Putnam's book, Our Kids. It used to be that when you talk about our kids, you talk about all of our kids, but now there's a shriveling sense of we, where we use the word our kids. We may focus singularly on our own kids, unfortunately, but that book, Our Kids, talked about the growing opportunity gap between largely low to middle income households with kids and upper income households with kids, and how it manifests itself over the course of a kid's lifetime.
Right.
And how education is the bedrock to that, and particularly early childhood education, which, Dave, part of the reason you and I focus so heavily on full-day kindergarten and pre-K, and we've made some progress in that territory. And but when you think about this, Dave, and you see the budget that we did, which invested hundreds of millions of dollars into education, including full-day kindergarten, and created the School Funding Commission, which we'll get to in a second, that you ably chaired, and closed loopholes for big out-of-state corporations like Amazon and Netflix, who sold products and services into the state of New Hampshire, weren't paying their fair share, while property taxpayers are taking it on the chin to help fund education for our kids. Mm-hmm. And then you see what they did. In this budget, how can they justify what they did in this budget, especially with a growing opportunity gap, including right here in New Hampshire?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it can be can be justified based on, you know, serving serving Granite Staters. I mean, I think the benefits or the winners, the money flows to, you know, select individuals, very few, costs a huge price for local property taxpayers, but really the biggest cost is in that opportunity gap that this budget actually moves us backwards. It doesn't take us in the direction that the School Funding Commission recommends.
And speaking of the School Funding Commission and the work that you've done, bipartisan, nonpartisan, leading that effort, can you talk a little bit about what the recommendations were, and including the work that you've done with folks like Attorney Bill Ardinger and others?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question, Dan. Because the commission met, and you know, I got to think it's probably close to 100 times over the course of 2020, and you know, it's 17 members on the commission. It had members of, you know, members were from both major political parties. We had Republicans and Democrats on there. We didn't necessarily always agree on things. We had a lot of heated debates and discussions on things. But I think when we boil it down to, you know, what were the key findings, and none of these things were obvious. They certainly weren't obvious to me going into it. And I chaired the Hopkins School Board for 12 years, and I thought I knew a lot about school funding. But none of these things were obvious. The first thing was that in fact depending upon where you go to school, your opportunity to succeed could be very different. And like I said, the average student in some districts performing at the 80th, 85th percentile, while the average student in other districts are at the 4th or 5th percentile. And you don't have to go very far to find those differences. Here in Hopkinton, we're somewhere around the 80th percentile. You go 20 minutes up the road, and you're at the 4th or 5th percentile. And that was really eye-opening. And then I'd say the second major piece that the commission found and recommended, and I got to give really give credit to this to Senator Kahn from Keene, who really said, hey, you know what? We're looking at this the wrong way. This isn't about costing out a bag of stuff, you know, 30 desks in a classroom and a teacher and stuff like that, and coming up with this crazy $4,000 cost of inadequate education. But it's the inadequate education should really be defined by student outcomes. What is it? What does it cost for the town of Hopkinton to educate its 1,000 students? And what does it cost to a statewide outcome? And what's it going to cost the city of Manchester to educate its 13,000 students to a statewide average outcome? And lo and behold, when you look at it and you drill down through the numbers, and we brought in some experts in this to help drive us through. It costs more to educate 1,000 students in Manchester than it costs to educate 1,000 students in Hopkinton, and so Senator Kahn said, look, we move away from this universal cost of education and look more towards, you know, a formula that recognizes the costs that are going to happen in different school districts based on the characteristics of those districts and the characteristics of those students. And then the third and final piece, I think, of the commission's major recommendations are we move away from this universal funding model So we have currently we have a universal cost model. We also have a universal funding model where you know, the Newcastle, you know, one of the most wealthy communities in the state gets the same state funding that you know, Newport gets or Claremont gets per student. And moving away from that, and frankly, where the state comes in with its limited, precious state dollars is to make sure that every school district has access to the resources it needs to provide that adequate education and closing that opportunity gap for its students.
That is, we're you just listened to Dave Luno, State Representative Ward 5, Hopkinton, and the chair of the School Funding Commission, and summarizing the work of the nonpartisan 17-member commission. So to the second point, Dave, in other words, an idea that, as you mentioned, driven by Senator Kahn or alluded to, looking at adequate education in terms of adequate outcomes. And talk a little bit about that student equity a little bit more and how that goes to closing that opportunity gap.
Yeah, so that's a great question, Dan. You know, tough to do here on radio, but
we do everything on Feltus and Kale.
So
no holds barred here.
in the commission's report, and the report's available to anybody that wants to take a look at it, and it's at carsey.unh.edu/school-funding. Or if you just, do a web search on New Hampshire School Funding Commission, I'm sure you'll get it. But there's a graph in that, or a scatter plot chart in that report that shows where the student outcomes are across the state. And every bubble on that chart represents a district, and the size of the bubble is the size of the district. And you can see the two biggest bubbles are down at the bottom of that chart. So those are obviously our two biggest cities. There's a couple small bubbles around there too, but you superimpose that with what these districts are spending on a per student basis, and there's a direct correlation on that. And so what other states have done, and Massachusetts is a good example of this, is where you have districts that have greater challenges, whether that's through greater instances of poverty or low socioeconomic students and families, whether it's greater numbers of English language learners, higher special education needs, that you direct additional resources to that, and lo and behold, the curve starts to straighten. You start to close those opportunity gaps where they exist now, and no, it's not going to happen overnight, but it's going to start to happen, and we need to be moving our state's school funding plan, school funding formula to a way that recognizes that and addresses that. And essentially what that does is it improves that, it closes that student opportunity gap for students, it improves student equity, and taxpayer equity follows that. And that's an important relationship that solves the student equity issue and you've solved the taxpayer equity issue.
Now, Dave, is the percentage of students attending public schools declining?
The percentage isn't declining, but the total number of students has been declining for years, and that's tied to the demographics that we have in New Hampshire. We've got an overall aging population in New Hampshire. There's fewer kids that are entering the system and fewer that are graduating from and I shouldn't say the system but school districts and fewer that are graduating as a result, and that puts you know a lot of challenges, not only on you know how we go about funding our schools, but also you know what are we doing for higher education, and what's the available workforce for our you know for our companies and our economy, and so you know this is all tied together as a you know as a system, and it's important more important than ever that that we make sure that that all you know 165,000 students are having a equitable shot at a strong educational outcome, so that they're ready when they graduate high school, whether they're going off to higher education, one of our fantastic community colleges, entering the workforce, entering the military, that they've got the skills and competencies there to succeed.
And there are some parents who believe that their children will have a better chance to succeed if they go to private schools. So, you know, thus, you know, the school voucher program was $70 million. Dave, is that what you said?
Well, that's currently that $70 million that's the state exposure for kids who are already going to private schools. So it would be additional over and above that for kids that or for families that might opt to have their student exit public schools and go to private schools. But we've already got nearly 16,000 kids in private schools, nearly another 4,000 or 5,000 being homeschooled, and basically three quarters of those students would be eligible. These students who are already, you know, families are already paying tuition, families are already doing materials and stuff, and they would be eligible this coming school year to get a you know $5,000-$7,000 check essentially to use for private school costs, homeschool costs, or frankly any other cost. The you could drive a truck through the legislation that created this, and there's virtually there is zero accountability on this, and so you know there's been a handful of other states that have done not nearly as extensive voucher programs as what's been enacted here in New Hampshire, and there's been instances of families buying you know jet skis and all sorts of other things and claiming it as educational expenses.
Dave, we've got about a minute left.
Yeah.
If you could quickly summarize for listeners who may just be tuning in what this recent right-wing radical state budget did on education policy and education funding, in a nutshell, what would your summary be?
Yeah, in the nutshell, it reduces state grants to our public schools. It diverts almost an equal amount of that, close to $100 million to tax breaks for big companies like Apple, Amazon, Walmart, maybe as much as $70 million to go to families who are already sending their kids to private schools, and for most more than half of the school districts in the state are going to see less in their state grant over the next 2 years, and that's going to be increased property taxes for all of us, and it will continue to exacerbate the opportunity gap that students face across the state. So things aren't going to get any better in Manchester, we're not going to be doing things right for our students or right for our economy because of it.
State Representative Dave Luneau, and Dave, great to have you with us as always. Great insight, and we look forward to having you back.
No, delighted to do it, Ken and Dan. It's great to be with you guys, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Feldes and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. We are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Feldes and Kale, we welcome you back to our program, and we are glad to have you with us. And we are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And we are shortly on the program going to be joined by our good friend Amy Hall from Granite State Dairy Promotion, and we'll be talking about things related to our New Hampshire farmers, particularly dairy farmers here in the state of New Hampshire. So always looking forward to Amy's participation in the program. 103.9 1450 WKXL, and Dan Feldes, Ken Kale here on Feldes and Kale. You can join us every day at 11:05. That is Monday through Friday, 11:05 for Feldes and Kale right here on WKXL, and also some other great programming throughout the day. You can wake up every morning and listen to Chris Ryan on his radio program that starts at 6 a.m. Would you like getting up at 6 a.m. and doing a show, Dan?
Well, I'm usually up at 6 a.m. With the kids.
Yeah.
Making some breakfast, getting some lunches ready for the day. That's kind of a time that we have set aside. I'm not sure I would do radio then, given that I'm already doing that stuff, but kind of hard to do all that.
Yeah.
But in any event, Chris has a great show and should tune in.
He does, absolutely. Great, some great guests as well every morning at 6 right here, 103.9 1450 WKXL. And right now, we're going to be joined by the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, and that would be Amy Hall. Amy, welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good morning, Amy.
We are doing well. We are doing well. And Amy, what are we going to discuss today in terms of our local dairy farmers, the Granite State Dairy Promotion?
Well, you know, I think what's appropriate to discuss is what everybody's been talking about, a very rainy July.
Yeah.
So, you know, I get asked a lot, how does this affect farms and farmers? Well, it's not specific to the dairy industry, of course. If you are in farming in any capacity, you can't control the weather. So it's a massive variable. And in years past, particularly in 2016, Dan will probably recall these times, we lost quite a number of dairy producers due to drought.
Yeah.
And it was an extensive amount of drought that, you know, left our farmers having to import feed, meaning, you know, their corn wasn't growing, the feed that they typically would sell to other farms, that source of revenue dried up, no pun intended. And we've been dealing with that, you know, mild to moderate drought for the last couple of years. And coming into 2021 and coming out of the crisis that was COVID for our dairy producers, they were all holding their breath. You know, they couldn't withstand another year of drought. Well, enter July, of course. So what is the opposite of drought? Flooding, runoff,
yep.
Too much rain, too fast. So this is a perfect example of what our dairy producers deal with. And it's funny, I actually was talking on the phone this morning with Rob Morrill. He likes to call me every now and then, catch up. They own Morrill Farm Dairy in Penacook. And I asked him, I said, so, you know, what's the scoop on the farm? You know, how's everything looking with all the rain? And he said, honestly, he says, we're okay. We've lost a little bit of barley. Now, they diversify and they grow barley and sell it to a local brewery as a form of diversification, because as we all know, our dairy producers are extremely intelligent business folks. So they lost that. Typically, they would have a, what we call in the industry, a second cut in right now. So when you see farmers out in the field baling hay, the goal is at least three cuts a year. So they all already have their first cut in, thankfully. In July, typically right around the 4th of July, is when the second cut happens. But unfortunately, it's been too rainy for them to be able to get that second cut in. So we're behind there. Today, thankfully, Rob was telling me, I got to run, I got to go. We got to, you know, we're waiting. It looks like it's drying up enough. We got to go get work on second cut. Corn is great. You know, it's thriving. It's healthy. A nice day of sun like today and hopefully tomorrow will dry everything out a little bit more. But we're typically right here in central New Hampshire. We're at that tipping point where too much more rain is not going to be good, and it can be just as bad as a drought.
Wow, really? Oh, I don't think a lot of people would realize that, but that's interesting. So you talked to Mr. Morrill at Morrill Farm. I hope that that barley supply is going to be okay. You know, we need it for that local beer that we have.
We absolutely do. Now, dairy is much more than milk, as we've discussed. Yes, folks, it's also beer. It can be beer. It can be flour.
Yeah.
They've lost a little bit of it, but they anticipated that. You know, when all the rain started to come in, each crop is variable in terms of how much water they need to grow, you know, how much sun they need to grow.
Yeah.
You know, to put it into perspective for everyday people, it's like gardening, right? You have shade perennials and you have full sun perennials. You have some flowers that prefer more water versus less. So it's really a tricky balance, especially when you can't predict nature. The good news is, though, is that here in this area, it's going to be okay. The concern now becomes the southwest corridor of the state, where we have seen flooding. We have seen, you know, massive runoffs, rivers encroaching banks. So there, that's going to be a little bit of a problem. But the good news is, too, is that our farmers are so darn resilient.
Yeah.
And they have to be used to the weather. I mean, this is just one of the major things that you have to deal with in farming. So they're doing their best, as they always do. More rain was certainly needed, just not sure that we needed this much rain. But it was good. The other thing that Rob told me is what would surprise people is still how dry that soil is underneath.
Mm.
He said, you know, even for him, he was surprised by that. And that's really attributed more to the torrential nature of the rain.
Right.
So the ground doesn't have as much time to absorb such large amounts of water in such a short period of time. So in an ideal world, I think farmers would love, just the same as everyday people, you know, give us 3 days of sun, you know, and a day of, you know, nice, just steady, gentle rain here and there. That would be the perfect balance, that's for sure.
It'd be nice if the weather could be as diverse as some of the farmers have to be, and most of the farmers in this state have to be to survive, you know. As you mentioned, so many farmers are, you know, diversification really is the key to success. I mean, you see so many, and as I realize this more and more, Amy, as I hit the ice cream trail and you know, see how many, you know, farm stands there are around the area, how many have their own, you know, ice cream shops on the premises of the farm where they make the ice cream. And really, you have to be diversified in the farming world these days in order to survive.
No, you absolutely do, Ken. That's an excellent point. One of my favorite things to say is, you know, farmers are very much executives in overall.
Yeah.
And we have been conditioned in society to say, unfortunately, because I've heard it, is that, oh, do-de-do, you know, stupid farmer. I mean, it's terrible to say, but that tends to be the social image that people have of our dairy producers. So in business, as with any business, you have to be able to change with the times. You have to innovate. And in the case of dairy producers, learn how to diversify. And we're seeing more and more of that. You know, and it's a proud moment. And it's something that I wish more people would understand. In terms of their extreme intelligence, you could put them up against any business owner and they'd knock your socks off. Our dairy farmers, they're veterinarians, they're feed experts, they're environmental stewards. They could tell you anything you ever needed to know about the environment, environmental protection agencies. You know, they are mechanics. They are everything from, you know, farmer to mechanic to veterinarian, you name it, accountants, HR, bookkeeping, they can do it all, and they do every single day.
And it's not a 9-to-5 job, folks. It's not a 9-to-5 job for sure.
Certainly not.
No. Amy Hall is with us. Amy is the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion and also brought to you by our local New Hampshire dairy farmers right here on 103.9 1450 WKXL and anywhere you go at nhtalkradio.com. Welcome back. Final segment of Feldis and Kale for this time around anyway. And our contract again was renewed, Amy, which is a surprise to some people, but we're back for another version of Feldis and Kale at 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. And proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And right now we have to consider this the latter part of the wet month of July. But that rainy weather, Amy, we talked to you recently about this, the rainy weather did not stop people from eating ice cream on the ice cream trail.
I'm telling you, Ken, I've learned in my days and my years, even long before this job, nothing stops people from eating ice cream.
Nothing.
Minus 30 degrees with wind chill, no, still eating ice cream.
You know,
pouring rain, no, still eating ice cream.
You think about it, though. Yeah, you think about it, though, Amy. Think about this. Really, maybe the rainy weather benefits ice cream sales because people are depressed and they want to be happy, so they'll eat more ice cream.
I mean, it could be, yeah. And the same could apply to winter months as well. You know,
yeah,
shorter
it's a good
days,
theory.
It's darker, it's cold. I mean, you could be onto something, Ken. That's a good research study.
Yeah, you have to figure that out, how ice cream sales on very hot, sunny days as compared to wet, dank, rainy days. You'll have to get your staff and crew on that, Amy.
Yeah.
And all your spare time.
Yes, the entire staff of me. I will get on it, Ken. I promise.
But nonetheless, the ice cream trail in full swing and will be. And as you told us last time around, you have to be careful about the days that the farm stands, the ice cream stands are in operation and the hours as well. You have until Columbus Day to complete your ice cream trail passports, but some of the ice cream shops may be closing before Columbus Day, so be wary of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our seasonal shops, and not all of them. There's a handful that are seasonal. You know, they open Memorial Day weekend and, you know, tend to close around Labor Day. So, yeah, just keep that in mind. Call ahead, and, you know, you'll be good to go. If you know the hours, you know when to go, right?
That's it. That is it. Anything else going on, Amy, that we should know about in the dairy world?
Well, there is, and it's really exciting, and I know we only have a few minutes left. But
we have about one.
Okay. Well, I'll put a teaser out. I am going to be working very shortly with Atlantic Media Productions, Nancy Vauder, and we're actually going to be putting together a half-hour-long documentary.
Ah.
Of New Hampshire dairy farmers sort of weave and wind and stitch together, you know, an amazing community, how they work together to, you know, benefit one another's families, but also the community. And there's going to be some hard-hitting stuff contained within this documentary. So we start shooting in October, and I will definitely keep you all posted on when that releases.
All right.
Wonderful.
We want to hear more about that. As you'll be joining us and keeping us posted on a documentary. How about that?
Mm-hmm.
That is terrific.
You know, it's going to go beyond the typical, you know, we're at X farm and this is how they operate, which of course is extremely beneficial for knowledge. You know, we've done that. They're housed on our website. You could take a peek at, you know, those farms and their stories. But at this point, you know, we've reached a time where we need to integrate more and penetrate more into consumers and the general public in terms of just how very important these families are and what life would look like in New Hampshire without them.
Amy Hall, Executive Director, Granite State Dairy Promotion, thank you as always.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
Feldis and Kale, another one in the books
at
103.9.
That's a wrap.
1450 WKXL, and anywhere you go at nhtalkradio.com.